Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in today. We are on Twitter at KUOW. I hope you'll join us. The New York Times headline said, "How Amazon Took Seattle's Soul." But the Seattle Times ran the same column and changed the headline to, "The Mixed Blessing of Amazon." Which is it? The Seattle-based writer of the column is Tim Egan, and he's sitting across from me. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Bill. Great to be with you.
Good to see you again. Your column is a warning to the cities who want to host Amazon's second headquarters. Be careful what you wish for. Amazon will shape you in ways you can't control. I know you don't write the headlines. Has Amazon stolen Seattle's soul?
Well, actually, I have to fess up here. I wrote that headline.
You did?
So as a columnist, you do get to write your headlines.
Oh.
But I didn't write the Seattle Times headline. But I know you, as a lover of nuance,
yes,
don't see everything in absolutes. I wrote the New York Times headline because I wanted to get an audience, and I thought it's close to what I felt. But I thought the Seattle Times headline reflected what was in the story as well. I mean, if you can't see the mixed blessing of this, you're not being fair. I mean, you look at more than 250 cities all over North America are throwing themselves at Amazon, we know as of the Friday deadline or the Thursday deadline, for the right to be us. And we're sort of shrugging about this thing. So, I mean, on the one level, you're just insane to see this as a bad thing. What's wrong with 50,000 jobs paying $100,000 in a clean industry? As I said, they're not mining coal. They're not cooking chemicals. They're not paying these associates minimum wage to say, have a nice day. I mean, they're the dream tomorrow jobs that everyone wants. And we sometimes have to pull back. On the other hand, you know, I, as a native Seattleite, like a third generation Seattleite, I kind of miss the old city, but who am I to mourn the old days? I mean, when you could go down to the Blue Moon Tavern and bump into someone who was, you know, semi-famous, but class differences weren't as sharp, and everyone didn't talk about the price of their homes going up. So, I mean, I just wanted to write sort of a mixed, you know, you will, and the important point that you mentioned, that you think you can shape this thing? No chance. Once it lands, the prosperity bomb, it utterly takes control of your city.
Well, Tim Egan, you just laid out a bunch of good stuff for us to get into. Let us start with the headline you wrote.
Mm-hmm.
How has Amazon taken Seattle's soul?
Right. So, I mean, it's,
What is soul? What is Seattle's soul? Let's start there. What is Seattle's soul?
As a lab Catholic still searching for that, soul is a nebulous thing. But I think soul is a sort of essence of self, and in this case, essence of place. What are our core values? Not necessarily our core political values, but what makes us? What's the character of a Seattleite? And I think one of the great things is we've never been that concerned about class or background. We've never been a place that the second question is, where did you go to school? How much do you make? It's always been, you know, what do you do after you work? And it's sort of changed that. So we have legions of people. I mean, the stereotype of the programmer looking down at his or her phone, mostly men, because it is majority men who are hired at Amazon. I think it's a 1.3 ratio to 1. And that's changed it. And then the lack of institutional memory. I mean, now look, I like fresh ideas and fresh people. I think cities need to be kicked in the ass every now and then. I think they need to be stirred. I've been in stagnant cities and they're terrible. But, you know, the lack of institutional memory, not knowing, not necessarily, you know, where Dick's Drive-In came from, but, you know, being able to share some of those common memories that make us who we are. The sole thing—
How can you possibly have both of those? If a city is no longer stagnant, it's been kicked in the ass and it's changing, how could people, everybody know where Dick's was and who cares?
Right. I mean, it's not that you care, but you can't just erase the past that quickly. That's a Seattle thing, even more than a Western thing. I mean, we're the city that came of age by knocking down our hills, by trying to make it into a flat place in the Midwest. That was the original dream of the Seattle founders, was to make this place like Cleveland. So it's always been, you know, I don't like to use this term, but that's what it is, in our DNA to remake this place. But through it all, there has been a, look, you've pushed yourself as far as you can go to the West, and here you are, and, you know, you're going to remake yourself, and the past is not that big of a deal. And you see that in some of the new Amazon people who come here. They certainly feel that. But that said, I don't want to see us become all about, you know, I said we're a city on amphetamines, and that's mostly, you know, what reflected in the real estate right now.
Okay. You mentioned that we didn't used to ask, what school did you go to? How much do you make?
Mm-hmm.
Is that just a feeling you have about these Amazonians with badges that you don't know? Or do you actually hear. I don't ask people. Who asks people how much they make when they meet and what school
well,
you went
to?
Does that really happen?
Directly, but you sort of do the cues that show whether you have it or not. I mean, I haven't seen a Pew survey that does an exhaustive survey of Seattleites. Do you? How many people have asked you who you make? I just hear it anecdotally.
I'm not looking for numbers. Okay, right. You hear it anecdotally.
I just hear it anecdotally. The people that the subject matters that you talk about are different. You know, I think it's.
You mentioned real estate porn or something like that.
Right. I said, do you want to really be a place where real estate porn is the number one topic? I remember going down to LA quite a bit in the 80s and 90s, having friends down there and just having free time. And that's all they talked about was how they could flip their houses. And I think that takes something away. I mean, this, I'm not longing for this because remember, I'm just sort of lamenting it as an open person. But this used to be a place where there, someone once wrote in an Esquire magazine that it was, there was a surfeit of lawyers slash carpenters. And a serious amount of quitting work at 4 p.m., you know, to catch a ferry somewhere. That's long lost.
That's what you mean by amphetamines?
Exactly. So we
It's work.
It's work. It's 80-hour work weeks. And I don't think that's good for anyone's soul, let alone a city's soul.
Do you think, are you picturing just that it's the newcomers who are working 80 hours, or did some of the people already here have had to
speed up whether they want to or not?
It
draws us all into it.
Tell me about that. Yeah. How does that work?
Well, when you control, you know, we are now the biggest company town in the United States. The Seattle Times did a great data breakdown that showed no city in the United States comes even close to any to us. The amount, the percentage of our office space and the percentage of our workers were tied to one company.
Although that is an overheated metaphor. The company town was literally where the town, there was one employer who owned, they employed everyone. They owned the place, the buildings where the workers lived. They owned the store.
I agree with you on that. The typical thing would have been the mill town.
Yes.
You know, a little hoquiam that's owned by one paper mill and they just tell everyone what to do.
Right.
I mean, you can see that in the pushback politically that we don't act like a company town. I mean, we've got people on our city council who want to tax jobs and make life miserable for Amazon. I mean, this was just laughable to any other city of the United States. You're doing what?
Right.
So certainly they don't own us in that sense. But the company town metaphor works in that they dominate us and they shaped us. And I go back to what I mentioned this in my column, what we could have done in a planning thing. I mean, I say, I get this argument with a friend. There was this idea we're going to convert South Lake Union into a giant park. Do you remember this?
Sure. It was the Commons.
Paul Allen was going to give all that property that he sold to Amazon to the public, to us, and we would have this huge city park.
Yeah, but the opponents called it a yuppie playground.
A yuppie playground, and it was too much. It smarted of like central control. You know, and I remember having this huge argument with this lovely architect friend who's a lover, and she said, no, cities have to grow organically. The little mom and pop shops in this. And how much did that grow organically? There's a great quote by the Amazon head of real estate in the Puget Sound Business Journal. He said, he remembers Halloween night in 2011. He said, I was given the order, buy it and buy it all, meaning all of South Lake Union, you know, in, on 2011. And that's what they did. Now, this, again, I want to pull back. In terms of New America.
That was so organic.
Yeah, I know. That really was organic, wasn't it? Yeah. Just little mom and pop shop shit. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's nonsense. It's put to lie a lot of our arguments. But again, I want to pull back. And this is why I'm nuanced on this thing. I'm glad they're here. I mean, who wants dirty industry? Who wants yesterday's job?
So if you could turn back time, you wouldn't have kept Amazon out.
No, I certainly would have. But I would have given all of us, meaning the public, a little more chance to shape their impact, which we never got. We are reactive now. We're entirely reactive.
How would we have done that?
You know, we could have done more in just terms of transportation and housing and shaping the city that we are becoming. So now we're becoming the Amazon city by default. We could have become the Amazon city with a little more of our public assistance.
Well, Seattle voters.
Shaping is what I meant.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm talking with New York Times writer Tim Egan and about what happened to Seattle's soul. But Seattle voters are about to choose between two mayoral candidates, both of whom promised to make homes more affordable. Do you believe them? Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, they can do some things like require developers to put more low to moderate income housing, which is one solution.
Build more housing, whether we like it or not, upzone.
You want to have a discussion about Seattle's soul, watch what happens if they upzone every city.
Aha, that's a trap, isn't it?
Right, and that's what these mayoral candidates are sort of dancing around the edges of, and that's a ripple effect of Amazon. The thing I always hear going back 30, 40 years from outsiders who've never been to Seattle is, my God, it is a city of neighborhoods. There's, five or six distinct hills and 20 distinct neighborhoods. But if you want to change Seattle entirely, upzone the whole town and make it just apartments everywhere. That will be that will lead to utter chaos.
But isn't Seoul inside those apartments and the things that the human beings in those apartments go out and do? I'm just a little wary of development means
right.
soul-sucking Borgs.
Right. I mean, is Seoul the, you know, empty South Park, you know, what was the giant cowboy boot we used to have?
Yes.
Always, you know, that's not Seattle's Seoul. But what produced the Sub Pop artists? You know, what produced so many great writers? I mean, as a writer, I love this city. We have so many terrific readers who show up for Tuesday night poetry sessions, you know, sell out poetry sessions. I don't want to see any of that go away because we've become so obsessed with the sort of financial hyper side. But I think, you know, again, I'm glad you're pushing back on this notion of soul. It's not necessarily quantifiable.
Yeah.
You know, it's a feeling more than anything else. And I'm not one of these grumpy old Seattleites. As I remember when you could get a place to park anywhere. I mean, who cares if you could get a place to park right then? I mean, I can get downtown on Sound Transit just as easy right now. So I'm not longing for, you know, a Seattle that was sort of homogenous and frozen, but just a Seattle that was a slightly different pace.
So you're not that guy. That's okay, because I have here a column that you wrote in 1920.
And the 1920?
Yeah, I went to Suzalo Library. I dug it up. The headline is "How Boeing Took Seattle's Soul" by Tim Hezekiah Egan. And it says, quote, "Remember my column from 1900 about how the gold rush had stolen Seattle's soul? Oh, I was wrong then. Now I can see we were truly soulful 5 years ago, right before Bill Boeing cut our trees down for his flying machines. Now we all rush about hither and thither as if on amphetamines. When will we get back to soulfully exploiting indigenous people and Chinese immigrants?" End quote.
Well,
and maybe I got the wrong guy.
Well,
I assume that was the same
guy.
Timmy
speaks in that accent.
Yeah, it's a newsreel.
I mean, what is that, some kind of English fop? I don't understand that accent.
It was. Right. I was going for kind of World War II newsreel, which was 20 years. Haircut. Sorry, Germans, not this time.
No,
Kaiser.
The best thing to happen to Seattle was, unfortunately, World War II. I mean, that's what brought integration to this town. That's what, you know, African-Americans came here because Boeing needed to hire people. That's what integrated Portland, which is still the whitest town in one of the whitest towns in the United States. I mean, Boeing brought big city sensibilities to the city. And, you know, the Tim Egan of then, I don't think he would have been saying that. I think he would have said, you know, this is good. We're moving beyond the homogeneity. I'm just saying the pace of it is.
To be clear, that was Tim Hezekiah Egan, different
guy.
Different person.
My grandmother actually was going in and out of speakeasies during that day out at Lake City. So that's what, I mean.
Really? How soulful.
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty soulful. There was jazz played in the clubs. And,
yeah.
You know, they were integrated and you could get cheap bathtub gin for probably 20 cents.
I was at a cancer research benefit last night at the Crocodile Cafe on stage with musicians from some of them who work at Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they actually play music, those tech bros.
It's, you know, they gave them some time off. That's great. No, they're changing.
They were working between
sets.
I
would like to see Seattle's unquantifiable soul, as you put it, change them as much as they've changed us.
Okay, so
that's what you just talked about. I think that's what you just talked about. You know, we ran a story in the New York Times earlier about how people are working so hard at Amazon, they cry at their desks.
Right, I remember.
They were really upset over that story, but they most admitted it was true. So I would like to see us, again, change them as much as they're changing.
Okay, so I tell my kids that complaining without taking action is called whining.
Right.
So what should we do to be more soulful, to be what we want to be?
You know, but I think one of the first things we need to do, and I'm trying to do this myself, is to reach out to these, you know, strangers. Don't look at them as outsiders. You know, talk to them, have them over for dinner, do something with them, go to a soccer game with them, do something with them, instead of looking at them as outsiders that have to be, you know, somehow legislated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bring them into our ethos instead of, again, it's going to
change them.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to change them. So now, one of the criticisms I read is that the restaurants that have come up around Amazonia are like a giant food court. You know, and I think there is something to that. That's another thing.
And why are they like a food court?
They're like, semi-interchangeable, hipster places that you could find if you drew them up on a grand design for what people want to eat.
Uh-huh. And a lot of fusion and nothing.
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah, okay. Instead of nothing indigenous. I mean, that's another argument, though.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Time for a final word. Tim Egan, what do you want us to take away from whatever happened between our soul and Amazon and what happens next?
Well, you're pressing on the soul thing a lot.
You wrote the dang headline.
No, I know. I wrote the dang headline, but you can see.
It's more fun than saying, what should we do about our mixed blessings?
Right. No, it is. It is true. And again, it's hard for a lapsed Catholic who's lapsed but listening to talk about soul because, it's a hard thing. But
are we in purgatory right now? How does that work?
they banished purgatory. Pope Francis got rid of it.
Vatican II.
I think there's two things I want to. That my parting message.
Okay.
One is, look, we're damn lucky to have them. And remember what the 280 cities who threw themselves at Amazon. I mean, they are just pimping themselves out. I said they're offering everything but free champagne in the drinking fountains to get them there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have a little perspective on how lucky we are to have hit the jackpot. Again, I'm going for nuance, a rare thing in media today.
That's, I'm playing with you. I know you bring the nuance. That's why you're my guest.
I don't mind it. You're good at playing with people. And then that said, let's accept the economic jackpot we have and benefit from and hope we get a lot of tax dollars out of it. That said, let's not let it change us too quickly. And now, how do we do that? I mean, it's going to be an individual thing. It's not going to be you or me going on stage and, singing the Ivers song.
Right.
And Ivers, by the way, was a guy who had this clam shack.
Acres of clams. You should know. We're wagging our finger.
And what was his song? In my happy seclusion, surrounded by acres of clams. I'm getting it wrong.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, something like that. And basically,
if I knew it, I'd do it in this voice.
Right. And that was Ivor, who came of age, with these the hipsters of their day hanging out on houseboats on Lake Union. And then he wrote this song about the happiest Seattle I could be, a guy just hanging on the waterfront eating clams.
Right.
So, but that's not it. That's just part of it. Okay.
That's part of it. Tim Egan, what are you writing now?
It's a too big of a subject right now. I'm wrestling. Right. I mean, for tomorrow's column or Friday's column?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did we get a sneak preview?
Yeah. I'm trying to do something on American tribalism and how, how Trump is pushing it on one side, making us all sort of race identity talk, and how the left is pushing it on the other. That the great thing about America, as Barack Obama always said, was that history would never allow someone like him to develop in any country but here. But now we've gone sort of retreating to this, and both sides are pushing it. But I'm developing my thoughts on this, so you shouldn't be.
Okay, I'm a big fan of the topic of tribalism. I think it drives a lot, and it's something that we can all look in the mirror about, because I think everybody, even if it's just rooting for your local sports team, something, you recognize the tribal instinct, the us-them instinct.
Right.
So I'm glad you're writing
about
that.
Raised as an Irish-American. I mean, we're very tribal and very clannish. We still hate the Brits after 800 years.
In a few little bit later in the show, I'm going to give a preview. Speaking of clannishness, have you seen this article for the East Side State Senate campaign that is it's a faux campaign for the Democrat, Monka Dhingra.
No.
But it's a bunch of Seattle stereotypes.
Right.
So it's getting the East Side voters to say, ooh, that's what Seattleites are like. I would never want to be like that.
Right. And that's out there. I mean, the rest of the state feels that. Do we want them to feel that?
Take a listen. See if I can play that. I'm not hearing it. Yeah, I guess we'll play it later. I'm playing something. Are we able to engineer bring that up? Okay. Well, we'll listen to it when we can. I think you'll enjoy it. It is a parade. I think the idea you talk about clannishness and tribalism. Mm-hmm. It's definitely, you don't want to be like those Seattle people. Mm-hmm. Just across the water. We couldn't be. We are indistinguishable to somebody from far, far away.
Right.
But it's that sibling rivalry happening.
And then one of the last unifiers was sports, and Trump made that about race. That's one of the things that really bothers me. He made it, these rich black athletes, now let's be resentful for them.
Yeah.
Sports is one of the things. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Eastern Washington this summer, hiking, going over there. You could still see Seahawk flags flying all over in between, all the Republican signs.
Yeah.
Now they've made that about, about race.
You can read Tim Egan in the New York Times next on Friday. Hopefully he'll be here at KUOW again. Tim, it's always good to see you. Thanks for that.
Great to be here, and I'll try to remember Ivor's song next time I'm here.
Let's play. I'll bring an acoustic guitar. We'll play Acres of Clams.
Okay. I can play three chords on a guitar.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Well, we have a show.
We have a deal.
All right. See you soon. Thanks.
No longer a slave to ambition.
Here it is.
I can laugh at the world and its shams. 'Cause I'm digging my happy condition here, surrounded by acres of clams. Surrounded by acres of clams.
That's the real deal, Tim. I don't know if we can do better than that. We might just have to let that stand.
That's fantastic, yeah.
That is Ivor Hagland. That's himself, right?
That's the audio soul of Seattle.
Oh, it's not Ivor. It's not Ivor.
No, but that's the song he did.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah.
Now you know. It's a restaurant in your town. Look it up. Tim Egan, great to see you. Thank you.
Thanks.
It's KOW's The Record. Back in a moment. It's KOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KOW. Thanks for tuning in today. In the late 1970s, David Neiwirth worked at a small daily newspaper in Sandpoint, Idaho, about 20 miles outside the Aryan Nation's compound. And he had to figure out how the paper was going to cover the hate group.
We thought, well, we'll do the smart thing. We'll ignore them. We'll pretend they're not there because they just want publicity and that's what they want. And which is, I hear that a lot from people. Well, why don't you just ignore them? Maybe they'll go away. And the problem is that it doesn't work. It has actually the opposite effect. They fester in darkness. They grow in darkness. They interpret the silence as tacit acceptance and tacit approval. So, yeah, within a couple of years of that decision, Northern Idaho was awash in a wave of crime and hate crimes. And that was when we realized, you have to shine a light on them. You know, don't just hold a little half candle with half knowledge. Reporters should be fully knowledgeable of what they're dealing with when they deal with these people, because then they can actually shine a very bright light on them. If you don't do it right, then it actually works to their favor as well. If you do a simple he said, she said approach to the story rather than explaining to your audience what these people actually stand for, then you're actually helping them.
Since those days in Idaho, David Neiwirth has not stopped studying and reporting on right-wing extremism in America, particularly here in the Northwest. His new book is called Alt-America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. He says online organizing has been a boon to white nationalism. It's largely what brought together the members of the alt-right, young white men who ground their grievances in identity politics.
They believe that Western civilization is under assault from a tide of brown people and feminists and social justice warriors, liberals, who they believe are degrading Western culture, and they want to combat it. There's a great deal of hatred of feminists and liberals and pretty much everybody else.
So that's who they hate. What do the alt-right want?
The alt-right, ultimately, especially its white nationalist component, really wants a white ethno-state in the United States, or at least a large portion of the United States, where whites and only whites can live.
And you've said that they see the Pacific Northwest as an ideal white ethno-state. Why is that?
Well, there's a long history of it here. Dates back, really, to the 60s and 70s when you had Klansmen talking about creating a white ethno-state, and some of them suggested the Pacific Northwest. And then one group of them from Southern California, the Aryan Nations, actually moved up here in the mid-70s and created a really significant presence here that we still really haven't recovered from.
I remember the Aryan Nations and the Skinheads and David Duke from decades ago. So what is so different now?
Well, there's a lot more of them. The big difference really is the internet. The internet has profoundly changed all of this. These people used to be really kind of geographically separated, spread out, and so they couldn't communicate with each other, couldn't organize, couldn't gain fresh recruits because they were really spread out all over the country. And the internet really erased that geographical distance and allowed these people to begin recruiting with each other. And the internet had a second effect, which was that, you know, you've probably noticed this in conversations and dialogues, especially with trolls, that dehumanization happens very easily on the internet because you're not really interacting with a human person. You're interacting with bits of information. And so one of the things that's very easy to happen is for people to start dehumanizing each other, to think of somebody they're even having a conversation with as just an object.
Do alt-right members actually expect literally a white ethno-state, or is this just a racist ideal they like to bond over?
Oh, I think they dream it. You know, it's a little bit more than just an idea to bond over. They have an actual strategy, you know. It's essentially an extension of the nativist strategy of self-deportation. Nativists have proposed for a long time that you get illegal immigrants to deport themselves by making conditions here so harsh and unpleasant for them that they just want to eventually remove themselves.
That's immigration, but what about, how does that lead to a white ethnostate?
Well, you'd create a white ethnostate by essentially resurrecting Jim Crow laws, enforcing them, depriving all minorities of any kind of civil rights or whatever other rights they might have. And
that means violence. So let's, right?
Yeah.
I mean, let's be explicit that we're talking about not just ideology, but an ideology whose only logical conclusion is violence.
It's ethnic cleansing.
Ethnic cleansing.
Yeah, yeah. That's ultimately where it leads. But they propose, of course, all kinds of legalistic means of getting there, all aimed towards getting, forcing people who are non-white to leave the region.
What is the most effective way to oppose the alt-right?
Well, they're fundamentally anti-democratic. Profoundly anti-democratic. They have nothing but open contempt for democracy and its institutions, including free speech, which is why you hear them complaining using free speech a lot. Their intention is to actually use the issue of free speech, one of the real institutions of a democracy, to beat it about the head and neck and actually help destroy it with. That's one of the things they talk amongst themselves. So when I hear Milo Yiannopoulos campaigning for
this. This is the right-wing provocateur.
Yes, and the one who came here to University of Washington, he's an alt-right provocateur. And not just him, but a lot of these guys talk about, you know, free speech. And I know that it's just a cynical ploy on their part to gain a club to beat their enemies, that is liberal democracy, about the head and neck. And that's what they intend to do. I think you defeat it by employing the tools of liberal democracy, and particularly the vote. You know, you get people out to vote. One of the reasons that we've allowed them to get into power is that a lot of people don't get out there and vote. You know, less than half the country actually voted last year. That makes a big difference. I think people understand that politics does affect their lives and makes a difference in their lives, and they get out and vote. But
do you see evidence that Americans will vote against this authoritarianism?
There are more of us than there are of them.
Yeah.
And a lot more of us. And it's just a matter of getting people out of their chairs and into the voting booth in a lot of regards. And we just, you know, the problem is that people have become disconnected and cynical about politics. They don't feel that the government's working for them. I think we really need to revive the values of democracy, make it a, you know, democratic nation again.
So you don't think tiki torch marches should be violently opposed, or punch a Nazi? You don't think that's effective?
No. I think that, you know, it's important to stand up to those people. They interpret silence as tacit approval. So simply ignoring them doesn't work. Pretending them away doesn't work. They have to be stood up to, but it can't be done violently, partly because they feed on that violence. That's what they do. You know, and not only that, I mean, the main thing they do is they dehumanize people. They demonize people. They turn people into just objects that, you know, yeah, it's okay to go punch. And you know what? I mean, yeah, look, I'll admit, Richard Spencer has the world's most punchable face, okay? But I don't recommend punching him because that's what he wants. And not only – and there's a reason he wants it, because he wants to use it as a club to defeat his – to defeat liberal democracy with.
So then outside of punching and ignoring – you're saying the ballot box, is that it? What's the most effective public resistance?
Well, I think there are a lot of ways you can publicly resist. I think that it is important to peacefully stand up to them. The most effective counter-protest I ever saw was in 2006 in Olympia, when the National Socialist Movement, which is a neo-Nazi organization, and they were based in Portland, they held a rally down on the Capitol steps in Olympia. And the crowd that came out to protest them that day was all dressed in clown outfits and Groucho masks. And they came out there and basically mooned those guys all day. It was hilarious and it was wonderful. It was actually the very best protest rally slash thing I've ever attended.
You found it hilarious, yeah. but how do you know it was effective?
Well, because that organization fell apart within a year. They were utterly humiliated. They sat up on the steps and just were red-faced and sputtered the entire afternoon. You could see that they felt humiliated. And like I say, yeah, within a year, that particular organization, it was based in Portland, pretty much fell apart.
I ask about the limits of hilarity because I grew up with Mel Brooks and, yeah, you know, et cetera, at a time of maybe less threat. But it might be easy for a couple of white guys like us, mm-hmm, to see the value in mockery but not feel as much at stake as someone who's targeted.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, obviously someone who's targeted, you know, they're not going to want to go out there and make fun unless they're in that mode. Obviously, it's a very serious subject. And making light of it isn't the purpose here. The purpose is to make them humiliated.
How high do you see the threat level, David? And again, I would not expect you to feel as personally threatened as somebody who's not a white man. Mm-hmm. But you've studied this. We talked about neo-Nazis in the 70s, 80s, 90s. How severe is the threat level to you today?
I think we're in very dangerous territory, mainly because, you know, the right-wing extremists have never really held power in America, not to the extent that they do now. And if they have the opportunity to consolidate that power, then I think we're in very serious trouble because I think they do intend to impose an authoritarian rule. I think they do intend to do away with, you know, the power of the vote and the institutions of democracy. I think that the danger is very real. I think democracy is under siege, and I think people need to awaken to this. We've lived for basically 100 years under a very stable system, at least since the 1920s and 30s. And that liberal democracy is under siege now, and we can't take it for granted. We have to stand up and defend it if we really believe in it. I mean, if you believe in those values that I think most of us do, but we've taken them for granted. And these people want to destroy them.
Journalist David Neiwirth, what else do you want us to know, finally, about the radical right today?
Well, I think it's very important to understand authoritarianism and this rise, this tide of authoritarianism that is hitting us, because and to look at it squarely in the face. Authoritarianism is, you know, has two major components. It has the followers and it has the leaders. And we tend to focus on the leaders. We're all focused on Trump. And we tend to be fascinated with that. We're not paying any attention to the millions and millions of people out there who are the authoritarian followers, because they're the actually important component in all this. And we need to understand the dynamic of how they think and how they act, because I don't think we can do this systemically. I don't think there's a top-down solution. I think this has got to be bottom-up. I think it's got to come from all of us as ordinary citizens and people, that we have to stand up to this individually in our lives, in our families, around our Thanksgiving dinner tables, talking about this stuff in a real way, in a way that actually makes a difference.
David Neiwirth is author of Alt-America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. And you can hear him speak at University Lutheran Church tonight at 7:30. He'll also be at Finney Books tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. But again, tonight, 7:30, University Lutheran Church. And he'll be on stage with, sir, do you know anyone?
I do, as a matter of fact.
Hello, Knute Berger. Great to see you. You're on stage tonight talking about Alt America.
That's right. Yeah, Dave and I will be talking about his new book tonight. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to it. It was a good interview, Bill.
Oh, thanks. Knute Berger, the Mossback Crosscut columnist. And, you know, this show, this hour, has been about tribalism in a way and us, them. Who we want to be, who we don't want to be. So I want to talk to you about that right now, Knute, because for suburban Republicans, when they want to bash Democrats, they could always bring up the villain, the specter of evil that is liberal Seattle. Listen to this new stunt political ad for an East Side State Senate campaign. It shows a parade of Seattle stereotypes with wool caps and hippie beads and hipster glasses and Lenin statue and bicycle, and they're all telling you to vote for the Democrat, Monka Dhingra.
Hey, Eastside, it's Seattle. We don't have enough liberal politicians.
Do Seattle a solid. Send Monka Dhingra to the Senate.
Monka Dhingra will give us free stuff. I love free stuff.
Who cares about higher card tab fees? The cars.
Higher taxes, bigger government? Oh, yeah.
Monka Dhingra is Seattle sophisticated, not like those East Side soccer moms.
Seattle? How many Seattle stereotypes did you spot in that ad? We're all liberal. We love being taxed. We hate cars. We apparently don't like soccer moms. And, Knute, you say that these stereotypes are a problem of Seattle's own making. Is that fair to say?
Well, partly. You know,
first of all, what'd you think of that ad?
I think it's funny. It's also pretty loathsome. the stereotypes that are being trotted out are, you know, their connection with the particular candidate don't seem to matter.
Right.
It's just like, well, if these people like her, she must be awful.
Yes, that's the tribalism.
And she's going to be doing Seattle's bidding in the state legislature. But, you know, I travel around the state. I lived on the East Side for a long time and ran a newspaper there. I know that a lot of the images of Seattle, you know, some of them are rooted in truth, and some of them are rooted in hard experience that people around the state or in the region, the Puget Sound region, have suffered over the years. We're the 800-pound gorilla economically and politically. Nobody likes the 800-pound gorilla, at least not since Bobo. So that's part of it.
There's another dated reference a la Acres of Clams. Look up Bobo the Gorilla.
That's so true.
Was that the Tacoma Mall one?
No. Bobo, that was Ivan.
That was Ivan, see?
No, Bobo was Woodland Park, Seattle's biggest celebrity pre-World's Fair.
By the way, just before we leave the ad, because people can't see some of the visuals, did you notice the gray-haired woman? I was like, is that offensive to East Siders, the idea that a woman would let her hair go gray? Because I've heard that's, you know, Maria Semple made that same joke in Where'd You Go, Bernadette, about seeing women with gray hair. And
right.
Stuff.
Well, you were seeing a woman who was still clearly an aging hippie who still wanted to get free stuff from the rest of the state.
What did that mean? We love free stuff. What did that mean?
I think it's a kind of dog whistle about welfare and about people who aren't responsible, you know, that kind of thing. And of course, that's preposterous because we are a net donor of tax money to the rest of the state.
Yes.
They're not giving us free stuff. We're giving them free stuff.
And that is a big statewide perception that's at odds. So now we're talking about your topic, which is this is a bigger systemic issue of Seattle not being appreciated and in fact being seen as the bad guy, the Bobo the Gorilla. So how does, if we send tax dollars out of here to the rest of the state, how is it that Seattle is the bad guy?
Well, there are several things. One is, that we are seen to spend more money on our projects that are state funded than we ought to. We have wanted elaborate lidding and, you know, went through elaborate process for the 520 bridge.
Yes, the lidding meaning building those nice parks over the freeway.
That's right, parks over the freeway and everything. And, you know, you'll note that the east side portion of 520 was finished much earlier. Seattle, it's taking years longer after much community debate, that kind of thing. So that's part of the perception. Part of the perception ties to the waterfront tunnel. Rest of the state, why not take a cheaper option? Why not have a raised viaduct replacement, much cheaper? Cut and cover tunnel, much cheaper. Surface option, much cheaper. No, we picked the big, expensive blah, 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 Bertha, you know. And they voted funds for that, saying Seattle area taxpayers will have to pay for the cost overruns. And immediately after the money was released, you know, Seattle said, we're not going to pay for that. So I think there's a sense, certainly there's a sense in Olympia that Seattle is selfish. Seattle wants its agenda to be everyone's agenda. Seattle wants an income tax. They want the whole state to have an income tax, regardless of the fact that the state has over and over and over again said, no, we don't want an income tax. So I think part of it is just those kinds of political push and shove.
And how fair do you think that is?
I think some of it's fair. The 800-pound gorilla does get what it wants, often, not always. And sometimes that's really important. I mean, we are a huge piece of the economic engine that runs the state. I think part of the thing, though, is more than statewide, it's also regional. In other words, there's, you know, there's this old competition between the wet side and the dry side, cougars and huskies. And, you know, back in the 1980s, that rivalry was largely humorous. You know, I mean, kind of it was more like these cultural differences that we could all laugh about.
Yep.
Now, with the sort of partisan divide, the red-blue thing, it's become more almost toxic. And
well, that was your reaction to that East Side Republican political ad. It was very divisive.
You know,
right?
if it had been an ad that went to, and there are such ads, that went to her specific positions and said, this is out of step with the East Side, that's totally fair. Oh, I will say, though, that Democrats do the same kind of advertising, not maybe with the sort of actors and the humor, but local Democrats always want to tie local Republicans to the national Republicans. So, you know, anybody running as a Republican locally is a Trump-loving, you know, Neanderthal type of thing. And so, you know, those stereotypes do get played out. But I don't think I don't think those stereotypes are really good for the region. And I think that goes for, you'll notice in the ad, the people are being snobby about the East Side.
Yes.
There's truth in that. There's also truth that people who move to the suburbs look at the cities and kind of disdain them. They're crowded. They're full of, you know, pretentious hipsters. So there is some, you know, little germ of truth in there. But those things are really irrelevant to the larger health of the region. They don't help us come together to solve issues like homelessness. They don't help us come together and solve issues like transportation, which are much greater than Seattle and the East Side. They're really Puget Sound issues. And I think as long as we have these, you know, sort of exaggerate the differences and ignore the commonalities, I just think that's not good politics.
If relations were better between Seattle and not Seattle, what would we be getting done? You mentioned transportation and homelessness. Give me some examples of what could happen if we reached out to one another, appreciated one another more.
Well, one of the things I wrote about in the story was, you know, talking with Ron Sims and Sims believing that cities are kind of obsolete, that we really live in a world where of the sort of mega cities, the mega metropolitan areas, and that we need to do planning and we need to do we need to think about the impact in one area on the other areas. Just as an example, you know, my my kids and grandkids have been priced out of Seattle. And so they're moving to, you know, one just moved to Bremerton. It's turning out that places that used to be remote from town are now becoming essentially Seattle neighborhoods with this economic diaspora, you know, that's spreading. But we don't really have a planning process that's integrated that helps us with what's happening in those areas. We don't have a region-wide. I mean, we have Sound Transit, but, you know, there are more counties being affected. I mean, people are moving to Port Townsend, Bellingham, Marysville, Lake Stevens, you know. I think there needs to be some kind of recognition, which I think is going to be difficult, some kind of recognition that we're not a bunch of cities that our future is competing with one another. There's some way I think we have to find a template to act more cooperatively in the broader Puget Sound region, at least.
You make a modest proposal your column, which is Seattle needs an ambassador. Who would that be? Yeah. What would the ambassador do?
Well, you know, it was interesting. I talked to the mayoral candidates a little bit about this, and I've talked to other people and just sort of said, you know, how can Seattle work on its... And it's more than just an image problem. I mean, it's a function problem. Here, I'll give you an example of something that really bugged me, which is you go down to a city like Federal Way. There's a city that really wants to be a city. They're going to get light rail at some point. They've created a commons area downtown, and they eventually want to get rid of all these malls and everything.
Strip malls.
Yeah. And you look at that and you think, oh, here's an area that's just desperate for urbanization. It's desperate for, you could put a lot of affordable housing here. It's going to be, you know, there's all kinds of roads and rail will be going through there. Yet Seattle went out of its way to steal their major employer, Weyerhaeuser, and put it in Pioneer Square.
Yeah.
Okay. Yay for Seattle. But what was the opportunity to look at that and say, hey, maybe Weyerhaeuser should stay where it is, and we could put a lot of affordable housing for people that work in Seattle in that town?
That's interesting.
And I think, and we did that with Tacoma. We stole their major downtown employer, the investment company, Russell Investment Company, and put it in the Washington Mutual Tower. Hmm.
Is that realistic that we wouldn't steal one another's companies as soon as we could?
I just think there's something that I think we're still stuck in a 19th century attitude. And the 19th century attitude was there's going to be one great city on Puget Sound. It's going to be me.
And the railroad is going to stop there.
Well, yeah, exactly. And you had Olympia, Seattle, Tacoma, Bellingham, Everett, Kirkland. All these places were competing to be like the biggest city. And we still have these weird competitions between like Bellevue and Tacoma and the Seattle. And it's sort of like, come on, you know, maybe we have to recognize, I hate to say this, but maybe we have to recognize that the big city on Puget Sound is Pugetopolis.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to figure out how to run it for the 21st century. Because these 19th century, you know, we're going to get the railroad and you're not. I just don't think it's sustainable.
So what's this ambassador going to do about that?
Well,
Seattle appointee, right?
And I'm not thinking of a celebrity. I'm not thinking about, you know, Nancy Pearl or Macklemore or, you know, somebody out there. It's not a PR problem. And I think the first thing, I would find somebody who's very smart about planning and policy and cooperation. And I would have them do nothing but maybe spend the first 2 or 3 years just listening to people. I would send them to places like Kent, which is radically changed in recent years. It's a majority-minority town now. It used to be 90% white. Lots of immigration, lots of diversity, and that kind of thing. I would have this person go to these different communities and find out what's life like on the ground. How is the growth of Central Puget Sound changing these areas? What do they need? And how can we cooperate?
Are you applying for the position you've just created? Ambassador Knut Berger.
Yeah,
right?
No, I am not. I am not applying for the job. But I have...
Macklemore can be your vice ambassador.
Yeah, potentiary, whatever that means.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think there's a lot of listening, a lot of fence mending, a lot of kind of reassessing what the priorities are. And I think it's going to take a long time to sort of change the culture, because in the past, people in the region have been skeptical about big government. They didn't like Metro. They merged it with King County. Then they created Sound Transit. A lot of people don't like that. I've seen Eastside politicians that used to be on regional boards often got punished at the voting booth for not caring enough about our potholes. So I get that there's a lot of trickiness. And I don't think people would want like a big government solution that was driven by the Seattle City Council.
Although judging by that ad, Seattleites love Shamisawant.
That's right. And they run around with hammer and sickle butts on their
standing
on their
next lapels. To the Lenin statue. And they either have a tablet or a man purse. Yeah. Or both. Yeah. We get it.
I think I got it.
Okay. What's wrong with soccer moms?
I've got to figure that out. Yeah. I think that's just made up. I don't think anybody in Seattle hates soccer moms, but.
The Democrat responded and said, I'm a proud East Side soccer mom.
Well, the fact is that the women's vote on the East Side is hugely important in this particular district, which is full of soccer moms.
Knute Berger, the Mossback and writer for Crosscut. We're tweeting out a link to Knute's column right now calling for a Seattle ambassador. And he's also going to be on stage tonight. As we were saying, we were just talking with David Nyberg, author of Alt America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. You and David are going to be at University Lutheran Church tonight, 7:30.
Yep. Yeah. Come on down.
Knute Berger, it's always great to see you. Thanks, Mossback.
Great to see you, Bill.
And thank you for listening. It's KUOW's The Record. We're on Twitter at KUOW. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the conversations that you heard this last hour. You can email us record@kuow.org. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.